Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the church.
I'm Nathan Wright, and you're listening to the Mormon Channel of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. A majority of the topics discussed on Legacy by definition concern church history, its founding, past leaders, and events. Today we'll be talking about the more recent history of the church in West Africa and some of the key figures in the establishment of the church there. Today we're visiting with Angela Ames, currently Assistant Curator of Church History at the Church History Museum. But before we get into today's topic, please, Angela, tell us a little bit more about yourself and what you've been working on recently.
I have been working on quite a few exhibits. Right now, primarily, I'm working on an international art competition for youth, which should be, we will start taking submissions in January, and the exhibit should open in November of 2012. So that's what I'm working on at the museum currently.
Listeners will remember Angela from our episode about the museum quilt exhibit called Pieces of Me. My brief introduction today of today's show does little justice to your topic, Angela, which is much deeper and far more personal than just recent history in West Africa. What actually started you on this amazing journey?
Well, I've always been fascinated by the people living in Africa. It's just something that I've been interested in since I was very young. But the church in West Africa just barely started to develop as I was growing up. The church became official there in 1979, which was just a couple of years before I was born. And so there was a lot of excitement and enthusiasm about the rapid development of the church there at the time. And we were hearing conference talks and all kinds of stories being told by general authorities about the church in Africa as I was growing up and through my formative years. And so I always learned to look up to the early members of the church in Africa when I was really young. And I kind of viewed the church members there as people of extraordinary faith and people to be learned from. And so I, as I was growing, always had a dream of going to visit there and going to meet the people there and to find out what it was about their culture that made them have so much faith. I read a book by Sherry Dew called If Life Were Easy, It Wouldn't Be Hard. And I'm sure that a lot of people have probably read it before. But she tells a story in that book about some of the women of the church in West Africa. And it was the first time she had visited there. And every time she goes anywhere, she usually asks the women about the burdens that they bear and the trials that they deal with in their lives. And at the time she was there, she watched all these women walking around on the street carrying these big baskets on their heads and carrying babies on their backs at the same time and bearing what she considered to be these tremendous burdens. And she asked some members of the church there what unique challenges they dealt with. And the response that she got from one sister was, "Sister Dew, we do have challenges here, but we believe in Jesus Christ, and so we are happy." And Sister Dew said that it really, that was a tremendous experience for her, and she thought about it all the way home and decided that they had almost nothing of the world's goods, but nothing but happiness. And we here in America have everything, but we're lacking happiness. And so it was a really important moment for her because she realized how much faith these women had. And that story was important to me in my life because it was shortly thereafter that I decided that I needed to go to West Africa so that I could learn from those women how to have that kind of faith.
So tell me a little bit about your expertise, the things that you love to work with, and that will kind of work into this discussion today.
Sure. I have a really keen interest in objects and art and artifacts and the way that they can impact and influence our lives and the way that they teach us things about who we are and can help us grow. And so my interest in material culture is really about the stories that come about through the material culture and our interactions with those narratives and how they change our lives.
Excellent. We have sitting on our table a little picture of some little statuettes. You want to tell us about those?
Sure. The first is a little carving that I bought in a market in Ghana in West Africa while I was there. And really most people would consider it kitsch because it's just a touristy trinket type thing that they sell in the markets for all visitors, and a lot of people buy them. But it's a carving of a woman, and she's carrying a very large basket full of probably goods to trade on her head. And she's got a baby on her back, wrapped up in her little fabric sling. And then she has another child standing in front of her, reaching up, needing to be nurtured. And I purchased this particular sculpture while I was in Africa because it reminded me so much of Sister Dew's story about how these women carry their burdens with trust in the Lord and with faith. And so I brought it home as a reminder to me of all the things that I had learned from the African saints about what it means to have faith.
So with that image in our minds of this little carving, let's talk about the beginnings of the church in Africa and some of the specific people that you met and know the stories of.
Sure. Well, the church has a much longer history in Africa than we usually talk about or discuss, because there were members of the church in West Africa, in Ghana and Nigeria, who were writing letters to the church administration as far back as the 1950s and 60s, requesting that the church be brought to West Africa. In 1961, they had their first official church meeting with some missionary, with a representative, not missionaries actually, who had been sent to West Africa. And it wasn't until 1978 that the church was officially organized in West Africa.
And so were the people in 1961 actually members of the church or just interested in the church?
They were converted to the church, but were not official members who had been baptized. Yeah. Joseph William Billy Johnson and a lot of others had been preaching from the Book of Mormon and had unofficially organized what they called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And so there were entire congregations of people waiting to be baptized at the time. And so in 1961 was the first gathering, official gathering of those saints with a representative from the church present. What's really interesting to note is that in 1979, only 1 year after the church was officially organized, there were already 1,700 members of the church in Ghana and Nigeria. So the church was growing really rapidly, and it was ready for a mission to be organized in 1980.
So tell us of some of your first impressions of the people and the members of the church and the women that you specifically got to interview while you were in Africa.
You know, my first experiences with the people in West Africa were not with Latter-day Saints. And that was a really, really important learning experience for me because all of the people that I interacted with were already very religious people. And I learned a lot about how the cultures and the faiths and the religions there were very strong and the people were very spiritual. It's not only Latter-day Saints who live their lives that way. And so it was much easier for me to see how the women of the church there and all members of the church there had become so faithful and so strong and so spiritual because of the roots that they had and the experiences that they had to build upon before they became members of the church. I interacted with some families there who really impressed me because not only were they very spiritually strong in word and could bear their testimonies very beautifully, but they lived very faithful lives. And I spent a lot of time with one of the stake presidents and his family, going to family home evenings with them and spending time with them. And one of the things they told me when I asked them what it was about the church that had changed their lives, how being members of the church had changed their lives, they said, "We became a family." And that was the first thing that really made me wonder about all the different ways in which the church had influenced the lives of the people there. And that's when I really started researching a lot about the history of the church in Africa.
So as I listened to your lecture and you described how you viewed this little statuette versus how some of the people in Africa viewed themselves, what are the differences and how does that associate with being members of the church there?
Yeah. So I have this little carving and this sculpture that I have at home, and to me it's this little reminder of faith. And I have always called it, I titled it Walking with Faith. And so I viewed these women as incredibly strong women who bore their burdens with so much strength and conviction in spite of their circumstances. And then I was doing research and reading a bunch of oral histories from 10 or 20 years ago after I had returned home from West Africa, and came across a kind of sister sculpture to the one that I owned. And one of the women, her name is Florence Chakwara, she told a story about how she used a similar sculpture in a talk that she gave when her husband was the mission president. And she said that she took this sculpture with her to give the talk, and she showed it to the congregation. And this is what she said. As she spoke to the congregation, she said to them, "African men think that they are above women, generally speaking. But when they have the gospel, they treat their wives differently. I was giving a talk on the family, and I went with my third world." That's how she referred to the sculpture. "You'd see the woman with the load on her head, with the child strapped to her back and carrying a child in her tummy. Where's the husband? He couldn't do something? I said, let's not be like this woman. Let us treat women with love and gentleness because we deserve it." And that was really interesting to me, that this very same sculpture that I referred to as Woman Walking with Faith, she referred to as the third world. And she had a very different perspective 10 years previous to my being in West Africa and being a native of West Africa. She had a very different perspective than I did on how that sculpture could be interpreted by someone looking at it and learning from it.
Which brings back the story you just told about the family who said the church has made us a family, basically. Uh-huh. So that was very interesting. This is Legacy on the Mormon Channel. We're visiting with Angela Ames about her recent lecture and research entitled Walking with Faith, A West African Vision of Women's Worth. Many of these women performed almost what I feel superhuman feats by anyone's standard. Let's talk about some other individual women, if you would.
Sure. You know, there are a lot of women who had extraordinary experiences as they were helping to develop the church in West Africa as early members. And three that I really enjoy hearing about are Priscilla Sampson Davis, Martha Mills, and Monica Opare. And they all have stories that are very extraordinary and display a unique spiritual connection with things that are going on in their lives. Martha Mills is interesting because she was a female who helped gather a congregation of Latter-day Saints. She was their leader, and she was widely known as a prophetess. She organized the congregation of converts under the direction of Joseph William Billy Johnson, and he helped her in preaching from the Book of Mormon. And there came a time when others who had originally been members of this congregation were encouraging her to remove herself and this group of people she had been teaching about the Book of Mormon from the doctrine of the Latter-day Saint Church, and asking her to separate themselves from the Book of Mormon and the things that Joseph William Billy Johnson was trying to take to their country. And she was persecuted a lot because she refused to set aside the Book of Mormon. And she was actually physically beaten by some of these people because she refused to remove her congregation from the Latter-day Saint faith. So at the same time, there were other female leaders who were building up congregations around the Book of Mormon of members who had been converted to Latter-day Saint faith. And many of them left the church because they couldn't hold the priesthood. And so when missionaries finally did come to West Africa and the church was officially organized, they were asked to hand over leadership of the congregation to priesthood holders. But because they couldn't continue to lead in that capacity in the church, and because they couldn't hold the priesthood, they didn't appreciate those changes which came with the official organization. But Martha Mills was different, because even though she had been so persecuted for her leadership and for her faith in building up that group of Latter-day Saints, she very gracefully entrusted all that she had built to the brethren and gave them authority over her congregation, because she understood that that authority came from the Lord and that they were acting in His name. So she was a really unique and special individual. And then Priscilla Sampson Davis was a great translator. Many times throughout her life, she had visions, even before she became a Latter-day Saint. And in these visions, she interacted with Jesus Christ. And she talked a lot about having the feeling and knowing that Christ wanted her to do something for Him. And many times throughout her life, she had tried to make other efforts, but had never felt completely fulfilled in the things she was trying to do, as if she had completed the task that He asked of her. And after she had become a member of the church, she had another vision. And in it, she was standing with the Savior in front of a congregation. And He looked out over the congregation and asked her why some of them had their heads down. And she said, well, those are the illiterate. They can't read English, and so they can't join in singing and praising. And she said that after she had told the Savior that, He said, well, I need you to open the eyes of the illiterate. And after that, she was strongly prompted that what that vision meant was that she needed to translate the Book of Mormon into the native language of Fonte so that those individuals could read and could join in the congregation. She was very aware of the fact that in the Latter-day Saint Church, you need to be able to study and you need to be able to read in order to develop a testimony. We place a lot of emphasis on reading the Book of Mormon and gaining a testimony of it, and in study and participation in our church meetings. And She really felt that if she could translate the Book of Mormon, it would help to open up the eyes and the hearts of others who were not literate in the English language so that they could gain a testimony of the church. And so she said that she could speak Fonte well, but she couldn't write it. But she just felt like she shouldn't say no to the Lord, and so she would try her best. And she has now translated the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, the Pearl of Great Price, Gospel Principles, and just about any other pamphlet or tract that
and
she
the hymns,
could get.
Probably, as you mentioned.
Yes, And it was really fun to read what she wrote about that effort, because she said she didn't tell anybody about it, that she was actually engaged in trying to translate the Book of Mormon. And when people came over, she would hurry up and hide everything so that they wouldn't see what she was doing. And when asked why, she said, "I didn't want my head to become inflated." So she was a very humble servant of the Lord. But she was very unique in her belief that there was anything she could accomplish with the Lord. She said, with a lot of conviction, "I've gone to school so I understand English, but if not, the Lord would have given me a Urim and Thummim to translate with. Isn't that so?" So she just had a lot of faith that if there was something the Lord wanted her to accomplish, he would provide a way and make it happen. So she was another one that had some very extraordinary experiences. We don't often in our worlds have dreams and visions that tell us things that we need to do and we need to accomplish for the Lord. But one more sister who I consider to be one who had an extraordinary experience that is not something we typically encounter in our average ordinary lives was Monica Oparé. And I love her story for two reasons. One is because she was a woman who chose change. And the other is because she lived the greatest love story of the church in West Africa. At least I consider it to be the greatest love story of the early West African church. But she decided when she was 15 years old that she didn't like the way that the women around her were treated, particularly in their families and in their marriages. And she didn't like the way that sometimes women were viewed as being subservient. And one day while she was out playing, she heard the next door neighbor being abused and beaten in her home. And she said out loud at the moment, "I would never allow any man to do this to me. I am going to work hard and strive hard and get up there to make sure that I am somewhere." And there was a young man playing with her out in the street, and he said, "Well, we shall live to see the kind of man you marry." And the kind of relationship she had hoped for and longed for was something that was not always common for women then in West Africa. So later in her life, she went to the United States for an American Field Service exchange. And while she was there, she joined the church in New York. And she was absolutely determined that she would go back to Ghana and give the gospel to her people. And she was planning on going to a university in America before heading back, but she got a letter from, coincidentally, the same young man that had made that comment earlier in her life. And in his letter, he said that he was ready to get married, but that she was the only one he wanted to marry. And she was really confused because here she was, a new convert to the church with a very strong testimony and feeling very intensely that it was her call and her responsibility to go back to Africa and share the gospel. But she was very hesitant to even consider the prospect of marriage to a non-member. And she wanted to continue her schooling at an LDS university. So she sent him a cassette tape and recorded her testimony and said, I was pretty sure that when I sent that to him, it would scare him away. But from his perspective, he said, this girl gave me a cassette where she related her testimony. When I heard it, I just went haywire, and I went to tell my mother, this is the girl I want to marry. So he wrote back, and he said, no, I really want to marry you. And they corresponded for a while. Anyway, when Monica received her patriarchal blessing, this is where the miracle happened. Because her blessing stated that a man who was not a member of the church was ready to marry her. And if she would, they would have great responsibilities in the church. So she returned to West Africa, and she married Emmanuel Opare, and he was baptized shortly thereafter, and they put him right in the bishopric. And after that, he was called to be the first president of the Accra Ghana Stake, and he became a member of the Africa West Area Presidency. And so now, there have been many hundreds of people influenced by her decision and by that miraculous event in her life. And she now teaches the young women of the church, after having seen these changes in her life and having had a very good relationship in which she is a partner with a man who trusts in the Lord. She teaches the young women of the church, the only dowry that I'm going to ask for my daughter is a temple recommend. And that's a very powerful statement because it's a very tremendous shift in culture, but expresses the importance to her of making sure that the young women of the church know how important going to the temple is, because having the perspective of who they are in the eyes of the Lord and of their Heavenly Father makes those changes that she experienced in her life.
And as you say, such strong culture has to be an amazing thing to overcome in such a short period of time, in just this 30 years or so since the church has been established there.
Mm-hmm.
You've been talking specifically about the connection between women's self-worth and faith in the church in West Africa. It's a principle that must exist elsewhere. Any other examples or any other thoughts about how this may have changed things other places in the world?
In other places in the world? Well, as I prepared my research and as I gave my lecture, I read a lot of information coming from the mouths of West African women about how they had often felt subservient and felt like they had carried heavy, heavy burdens of supporting their children and raising them on their own. And I was feeling a little disconcerted about it and feeling like it kind of downplayed the nobility of the woman in West Africa. But the more I pondered it, the more I realized that we all, it doesn't matter what culture you come from, anywhere you live in the world, we all have moments when we feel like we are carrying a heavy, tremendous burden. And when we feel like the people around us don't necessarily recognize our worth or treat us as if we do have an eternal nature and a tremendous worth. And, one of the things that was stated by some missionaries in West Africa was that going to the temple really did change the perspective of the woman and help them understand that they had a divine worth. And I think that, like I said, no matter where you are, even here in America, we all struggle with feeling like we aren't necessarily appreciated and viewed that way by others sometimes. And we all have to go through those experiences where we realize who we are in relation to our fellow human beings, in relation to our families, in relation to our God. And that's what the doctrine of the church, I think, does for many, many women the world over, is help them understand the role that they play in an eternal scheme and in relationship to their Father in heaven. And it really does empower a lot of women to understand that role.
Any other stories or thoughts about your time in Africa or some of the people from there that you'd like to share with our listeners?
You know, most of the most touching experiences I had came after my trip to West Africa. And I met a lot of really strong women there and women who had a lot of faith. But I also came to realize that they were just living their lives every single day like we do, doing the best they can every single day. And so a lot of the women that really had an impact on my life were the women whose stories I read in the archives of the church after I had returned, and I could see the change that had occurred in their life from the beginning of an experience to the end of an experience. And I could see the progress that they had made that they could look back upon. And so a lot of times in all of our lives, we only see the here and now, day to day. And so often those women in West Africa didn't seem to be extraordinary to me while I interacted with them on a day-to-day basis, because they seemed to be just like I am, mm-hmm. you know? And it wasn't until much later when I could look at some of their lives in a whole and complete context that I realized how very extraordinary a lot of their experiences really were.
Excellent. So your lecture entitled Walking with Faith, A West African Vision of Women's Worth, is that available anywhere that people could actually listen to it or view it, or tell us about that?
It's actually, there's a podcast of that lecture on the church history website on LDS.org.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. This is Legacy on the Mormon Channel, and we've been visiting with Angela Ames today in her recent lecture, as I mentioned, Walking with Faith, A West African Vision of Women's Worth. Angela, thank you very, very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Nathan Wright, and you're listening to the Mormon Channel of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We invite you to listen to new episodes of Legacy Saturdays at 1 o'clock. You can also download any Legacy episode at mormonchannel.org.